time now for the infectious disease program. We got Sharon Sanders on the line from the original Flu Trackers. She's on. She has a guest on with her, I believe. And Sharon, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great. It's still hot here in Florida, though. We had a couple of cool weather days. I thought we were going to see some fall, and now we're back to summer again.
Back to summer. Well, that happens in the Sunshine State, I suppose. So you've got your guest on the line there?
Yes, I'm very pleased to announce that we have John M. Barry today. He's a distinguished scholar of Tulane University Center for Bioenvironmental Research. He's an advisory board member of the MIT Center for Engineering Systems Fundamentals. He's an author. He's best known in, I guess, our circles as the author of The Great Influenza. He's also written Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. He's also written Power Plays, Politics, Football, and Other Blood Sports. Most recently, he's also written a white paper on H1N1 that he prepared for MIT, and he also has a recent commentary that was published in Nature. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yes. Well, what's your assessment of what's going on right now?
Pretty much the same as everybody else's, I guess. You know, I think the vaccine is more a problem of communications and expectations than anybody screwing anything up. And in terms of the pandemic itself, we're still wait and see.
Well, I've pulled the numbers before every radio show, and the numbers are so incredibly low. I think only this last week, only 27 countries reported to WHO. Many of them are not testing for H1N1 specifically anymore. Looks like China is getting quite a bit of H3N2. It's hard to track what's going on from any sort of definite quantitative evaluation. We're following, at this point, pneumonia and influenza-like illnesses. Have you got any information of what's going on in that area?
Not really. By coincidence, I had lunch today with a friend who works on influenza in the White House, and he didn't really have anything to share that you don't already know. I think the biggest question that's out there that we don't know the answer to, and that we could if we devoted some resources to it, would be how many people actually are getting exposed to the virus. And unfortunately, I don't know of anyone who collected that data after the spring outbreaks, which, you know, we could have done by sampling, doing some blood work, looking for antibodies, would have had a pretty good sense then in the areas of how many people had been exposed. And I think that's important because, you know, there are sort of two alternative scenarios that I'm sort of speculating about. One is that throughout history, there were probably pandemics that we don't know existed because they didn't really kill many people. And, you know, they're probably extremely, we don't know this for certain, but I think it's highly likely. And the other, and possibly this is something like that if this had happened 200 years ago, or for that matter even 100 years ago, and it were just like what we're experiencing now, we wouldn't know that it ever happened. Alternatively, it could be that we're still seeing, you know, nowhere in the world yet does it look like we've had really high levels of sickness. And normally the pandemics that we do know something about, 1889, 1918, 1957, and 1968, in all of them, you did have very high morbidity, somewhere at least in the 25% range and often higher than that during the peak wave. All four of those pandemics came in waves, and in every one of them, the waves were different. So which is it? Is this a pandemic that what we see is all we're going to get, which would be very nice, because although some people are dying, obviously it's not an Armageddon scenario. Or is this a virus that is not quite fully adapted to the human population yet, and, you know, maybe in a few months, maybe even in a couple of years, we'll see an explosive wave. I think when the White House Advisory Council, whatever their actual title is, committee, it was chaired by Harold Varmus, a Nobel laureate, but not a guy in infectious disease. And back in, I guess it was July, they issued a sort of a prediction that between 30% and 50% of the population would get sick in the fall and winter waves. And they stated, in fact, that they based that prediction by going back 100 years. However, if they'd gone back to the 1889 pandemic, they would have seen a very different scenario. In 1889, unlike 1918, 1957, 1968, the virus seemed to hit pretty sporadically for almost 2.5 years. You know, it hit big cities like London, Berlin, New York, but it never really dug in, and it was noticed. It hit them hard enough that it was noticed in beginning in May 1889. But it was not until 2.5 years later, the winter of 1891 to 1892, that it really caused sort of blanketed the world with heavy morbidity, and that was also the most dangerous wave. So, is this a long war? Is the virus going to wait 2 years? Or longer, or 6 months, or whatever, before it really causes tremendously widespread disease? Or is this what we're going to get, what we see right now, and it's not going to get any worse? I don't know the answer to that. I think if we had some better data on morbidity, then we would have a much better feel of what the end result would be like.
Correct. You know, people ask me all the time. I'm not a disease expert either, and really, we just really don't know. I don't think any pandemic's been studied like this one has. You know, I think we'll have a lot of answers for the next one.
Well, again, this data. I agree with you. Certainly, we're getting a lot of resources devoted to looking at this, but there are also some, you know, major questions that could be answered that we did not spend any time answering, and it's already probably too late to do the serological study to figure out what the spring exposure was, because it's been contaminated by fall. So we'll never get that data, and that's unfortunate. And eventually we'll probably have serological studies to tell us just how many, you know, what percent of the population has been exposed to the virus. To H1N1, I should say, this time around.
Last week, the CDC did announce that almost 90% of the deaths related to swine flu through September 1 were people younger than the age of 65. So it's a young person's disease.
Right, that's clear, and I figure probably most of the people who listen to the show are familiar with the basics, and this is not really a disease with a bell curve either. I mean, there's somewhat of a bell curve, but it's more like you have this overwhelming majority of the cases are really mild, and then you have at the other extreme this small number of cases, but in those cases the virus is extremely virulent, far more virulent than seasonal influenza. Certainly your regular listeners are probably well aware of that, but I think that's important to note, and the reason, and you don't get that kind of virulence from seasonal influenza. The reason is the H1N1 has the ability to bind to cells deep inside the lung, and seasonal so it therefore can cause viral pneumonia. Seasonal influenza does not have the ability to bind to those cells in the lung, so it almost never causes seasonal influenza. Viral pneumonia, excuse me. Misstated my sentence there.
Are you hearing anything about tamiflu resistance spreading? Seems that, to me, anecdotally, as I look around and also stated in the European Center of Disease Control, their latest document they've produced, that there's a Tamiflu-resistant strain identified in Hong Kong. Are you hearing anything about that this issue?
Not really. You know, the intermittent, you know, isolated reports. You know, certainly the, I think eventually, if the virus can become resistant, it will become resistant. I think that's essentially inevitable. And clearly it can become resistant. However, you know, will that happen in a few months? Will that happen in a few years? That's not clear. Seasonal H1N1, and there is an H1N1 virus which comes every year. In the United States, that virus is almost 100% of those samples are resistant to Tamiflu. But in Japan, which historically has prescribed Tamiflu probably more often than any other place in the world, only 2 to 3% of the H1N1 seasonal viruses have been resistant to Tamiflu. So, and you'd expect it the opposite, of course. You'd expect the where the virus sees Tamiflu a lot, it would become resistant. So there is just so much random activity with any influenza virus. In the meantime, Tamiflu does work in the overwhelming majority of cases. It's not a magic bullet, but it is useful.
Of course, Friday the FDA approved the emergency use of Premierivir.
Right.
And I guess for what, intravenous use for the most serious cases?
That's correct, yeah. And hopefully that'll work.
Does that, President Obama's emergency declaration opens the road for that? Is that a reason to declare emergency?
I don't know enough about the actual procedures. My impression is that that's a separate action by the FDA. But it could be related to the emergency declaration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that bureaucratic, exactly what is triggered, I frankly haven't paid that much attention to.
So would it be safe to say that you are sort of, pro swine flu vaccine?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
And I think anyone who does not get it when it's available is you know, it's yeah, I mean, I'm sure there is some, you stick anything in your body, give it to several million people, much less tens of millions of people, there will be some adverse reactions. But you compare that to the number of people who would become severely ill or die from the virus, I don't think it's even a close call.
Mm-hmm. Well, this time the swine flu vaccinations coming into the United States do not have adjuvant, but it's widely approved for Canada and Europe, in fact, most other places. Do you have any feelings on the adjuvants?
You know, I think they've used adjuvant, particularly in Europe, for a long time. I don't really know of data showing significant adverse reactions. I think there's some slight increase in adverse reactions with adjuvant. I think the reason it's not approved in the United States is primarily politics, because of all the concerns about autism that surfaced a few years ago. But every study who has looked at that issue has concluded that vaccinations and the preservatives were not linked to autism. And maybe the most telling data that demonstrates there was no link whatsoever, the fact they take that stuff out of the vaccines and those preservatives out of the vaccines, and the autism rates have not gone down. So that would strongly indicate that there was no link. And, you know, nonetheless, the politics are such in the U.S., we do not have adjuvants to spread out. And so the audience understands what we're talking about. An adjuvant stimulates the immune system, so you need less virus, less antigen from the virus to get an immune response. It's referred to as an antigen-sparing strategy, so you can get more doses out of the same amount of vaccine. As you indicated, they do use it elsewhere in the world. We don't use it here in the U.S.
Right, and thimerosal is not an adjuvant. It's a preservative, and they put it in the 10-vial bottle, because 10-dose vial, because every time you introduce a new needle in to take a new dose out for another person, you introduce a chance of a contaminant going into the rest of the bottle for the rest of the people that are taking it. So they do put the thimerosal in a 10-dose bottle. But it is there is a no-thimerosal dose available in the United States for, I think, children and pregnant women, no?
That's correct, although I understand it's extremely hard to find.
Yeah, I don't think they ordered as many of those. But anyway, one thing that kind of aggravates me, I think I will say, when I'm, you know, we're a news aggregator, we also have commentary, we do all this research, I still see some really mixed messages coming out of the different governmental agencies around the world. I see a lot, sometimes some major news outlets also publish things that are not, just frankly, accurate. And so this gets us to the communication aspect of communicating pandemic influenza. And you considered it, I saw a quote from you saying that you considered, you know, there's two legs, really. One is a vaccine, and one is the communication of the situation.
Right.
How you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I just think that really in any crisis situation, whether it's something like a pandemic or my home's New Orleans, whether it's hurricane, you're in Florida, hurricanes, I think communications is absolutely essential. And in something like an influenza pandemic, if you're going to ask people to, you know, implement various what they refer to as non-pharmaceutical interventions, in other words, what do you do when you don't have drugs? If you're going to get people to comply with your advice on that, then you have to have a very, very good communication strategy. And I define a good communication strategy as having people believe you. And people believe you when they're convinced you're telling the truth. And the way you get them convinced is to tell the truth. So I think that in what's referred to as a risk communication profession, that phrase risk communication is something I'm not too fond of, because it sort of implies managing the truth. I don't think you manage the truth, I think you tell the truth. I think that by and large in the U.S., you know, they fumbled a couple of things, but not because they were trying to manipulate information, just because they fumbled a couple of things. People make mistakes. I think they have tried to be transparent. I think things where they've erred, such as earlier when they were communicating how many doses of vaccine were going to be available, you know, I think they probably could have done a better job on that, because I think some of the areas where they ran into problems were a little bit predictable, and you know that. But by and large, I think the U.S. has done a pretty good job, particularly compared to a few other places in the world. I was in China about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they were still saying, since this disease comes from outside, they had just gotten vaccine there. They said they were going to concentrate distributing the vaccine in the areas where there were most contact with foreigners. Well, they already had how many thousands or millions of cases inside China. It was no longer relevant that even though, you know, even though the virus did come from outside, it's no longer relevant to start dealing with areas where there are a lot of foreigners. That was just stupid. And similarly, another country, you know, was saying, well, now that we have a lot of cases inside the country, we're going to redouble our efforts at airport screening. I mean, this is obviously ludicrous. You know, compared to, or Egypt, where they were slaughtering all the pigs, compared to countries like that, the U.S. deserves an A+.
Yeah, it's hard to evaluate, really. I just look at sort of general big things that you can't miss, like the one study in Canada that said if you got the seasonal flu shot last year, you were more at risk for the swine
right.
flu this year, and then that study never got released, and then, you know, there were studies generated that said, oh, no, actually, you may have an accumulative effect of being in a better shape, because if you've gotten the flu shots over 2 or 3 years, you actually have a better chance to fight off the swine flu. And, you know, you look at this and you just go, you know, what do you do? I mean, it's really tough, I think, for most people to evaluate what's going on out there.
Well, that's true. And to a certain extent, you can never fix that problem, because different investigators are going to publish their work, and the work is not always going to, be consistent. The conclusions will not be consistent. You can't really blame a government communication strategy for inconsistent scientific conclusions. However, it is important that, it's more important that they be right than that they be consistent.
Or maybe even if they're wrong, particularly if you're talking about the governmental employees, that they just say, I was wrong on that.
Exactly. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I give the U.S. very good grades. If you go back to the spring, there was a point at which they had a fairly aggressive school closing policy, which, frankly, I disagreed with. And 72 hours later, they reversed themselves and said that school closing was not a particularly useful way to contain the pandemic, not effective, I think was the word they used. So, within a 72-hour period, they actually did reverse themselves, and that is very unusual for any government agency. And so I think for that, they should get an A+.
The school closing issue is fairly controversial. I'm seeing a lot of high passions on both sides. My own anecdotal evidence is I'm seeing local school jurisdictions handle it basically the way they want, and I'm seeing everything from a very rigid standard of not letting children out so much, demanding notes and all this kind of thing, to basically don't let your child come to school if they're even slightly sick, and we're not going to demand any doctor's notes, and we're going to help you with your at-home schoolwork. Seems like each school district is sort of doing their own thing.
Well, in terms of requiring notes and not letting kids go home, if there are districts doing that, I think that's foolishness. I certainly think if a kid is sick, the kid should not go to school. In terms of notes and things like that, I think given the burden on the healthcare system, I think that should be waived. In terms of actual closing a school, I think that really should be a local decision. At this point, I doubt very much that it would have much impact on the course of the epidemic in a local community. I think, though, if you've got really high rates of absenteeism in a particular school, you can't very well conduct teaching, and, kids are not going to learn. And plus, so many are absent, you'd have to go back over it. So it may make sense in a few local instances with really high absenteeism, or maybe for some other reason, if all the teachers are out or something like that and you can't get substitutes, it might make sense to close schools. But as a broad brush control measure with a disease that at this point, fortunately, remains mild in the overwhelming number of cases, then I would oppose school closure.
You probably have seen these articles that I've seen, which are anti-pandemic, saying there's only been 5,000 people that have been killed worldwide with this, and therefore it's no big deal. And they use the numbers, the gross but understated numbers by the WHO or even the U.S., which both of those entities say that their numbers are understated in their documentation, but they seem to go with some of the numbers and say this is not a pandemic, it's just some other trick, or I don't know. Really, they're quite outlandish, their essays, but they do get published, and some of these essays get published in quite renowned venues. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, I mean, you've got a lot of nuts out there. And, you know, I would dismiss them as nuts, frankly. You know, clearly it's a pandemic by any definition. Even if the 5,000 deaths number were accurate, which it probably isn't because it's trailing, you know, this is still just starting. As I said at the beginning, it's possible that had this, you know, maybe this is all we'll get. And if it had happened 100 or 200 years ago, it would have passed without any notice. It's only because we were out there looking for H5N1 and we have better reporting now and so forth that we were even aware that it happened. Not to mention molecular biology. You know, but no one has, you know, can possibly predict at this point what the future is going to hold for this virus. You know, is it going to be like 1918 and turn virulent? There's absolutely no sign of that, very fortunately. But it could easily, as I said earlier, you know, be like 1889, which kicked around for 2.5 years before the virus really exploded and, you know, caused very widespread disease. This time around, within 2.5 years, we'd certainly have plenty of vaccine available. So that would be a good thing. But you'd still get the morbidity, you'd still get the economic disruption from people being out sick and so forth. You know, I've been on one Fox show where the host actually told me that I had convinced him that this was not a plot by the Obama administration to pass health care, but I know there are people out there who say that. It's just, it's nuts.
Well, at Flu Trackers, we're nonpartisan. We've been operating since February of 2006, and that was a different administration, so we're just following disease. You know, we're just following disease characteristics of really around the world, and it's really clear to us, and, you know, we have a lot of experts on the site. It's very clear to us that, you know, you have a real pandemic here. Just some of the major characteristics of it hitting young people in a very disproportionate and different way than seasonal flu, and the fact that it's animal-based tells you that you've got something that really everyone needs to keep their eye on, and it's a killer. It, you know, like you said, it's almost like two different diseases.
I need to break in and take a break here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Alrighty, we'll be back with the infectious disease program right after this.
Can't sleep? Then Ciara may be the answer for you. Go to www.americaswebradio.com, click the pain relief button, and check out the Rest Quiet Chip. It's non-invasive and can give you the aid in sleeping you've been missing.
Hi, this is Ann Lauren, host of the new Bella Petite Hour, featuring guest fashion photographers, models, celebrities, beauty experts, and industry professionals. Tune in every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at America's Web Radio to the premier talk show for petite women on the Internet.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood, and I practice family medicine in the Houston area for over 26 years. A few months ago, I was introduced to a holographic pain-relieving chip by a young man I'd coached in Little League Baseball 16 years ago. Skeptically, I tried the chip on my right knee, and amazingly, the pain I had experienced for the past 2 years was significantly improved in hours and gone within weeks. And although the chip does not heal or cure, the pain relief was remarkable, and I will continue to wear the chip. To find out more about this product, go to americaswebradio.com and click on the pain relief button. It works for me, and it just might help your pain problem as well. I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood. Thank you for your time.
Is there a cure for glaucoma? How does LASIK eye correction work? What is the difference between hard and soft lenses when it comes to contacts? If you or a close friend has any questions like these, then waste no time. You need to be listening to For Your Eyes with host Dr. Andrew Schatz. Dr. Schatz is a board-certified ophthalmologist and is here to answer your questions. So tune into Radio Sandy Springs, 1620 AM, and stream live at www.radiosandysprings.com every Monday from 5 to 6 p.m.
Learn about non-invasive pain relief by going to www.americaswebradio.com and clicking on Pain Relief. You'll also find an answer to insomnia and energy assistance. Don't put it off a minute longer if you suffer from chronic pain.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
And now back to the infectious disease program. Sharon Sanders is on the line with her guest. Back down to you, Sharon.
Hi, thanks. Like I was saying, you know, we're a nonpartisan site, and we've been up since February of 06, and, you know, we just follow disease, and it, you know, we have a lot of healthcare workers and professionals and doctors and moms and dads, and it just seems that, you know, we're definitely in a pandemic, and, you know, when I see some of these, I would just say kind of crazy, wild conspiracy stuff flying around, it really does, it has the potential to hurt people if they don't decide to take some of this seriously.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, we can almost stop talking about it because I agree completely.
I took a look at your MIT speech that you gave, and in there you talked about the ferret study. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Is there a link to that on my website, or was this Googled? I can't remember. This is a talk I gave fairly recently, a couple of weeks ago. In fact, it doesn't matter when I gave it. But my understanding is that ferret is the animal model used to study influenza most commonly. And if you put ferrets in cages a certain distance apart, seasonal influenza will transmit, you know, at X feet from one cage to another, even though there's no other contact. And yet H1N1 will not transmit. This is according to some work done at CDC. So that is one of the reasons why, you know, I've been speculating that the virus is not as infectious right now as it might become, which leads back into the question of whether or not this is all that we're going to see, or whether the virus is going to become much more infectious, like most of the other pandemics that we've seen in history, and end up making 25, 30, 40% of the population sick in one wave. And, you know, there are other small pieces of evidence, and I, like many other people, you know, take a little hint of something and try to make sense of it. And whether that's what's going to happen is anyone's guess. I might be right that the virus is not as infectious as it could become, but even if I am, that doesn't mean that the virus is going to end up moving in that direction. It might not.
The reason why I ask is because, you know, of course, we have a lot of healthcare workers, and we are very concerned about their welfare because they're one of the, you know, the fabric of society, along with families and healthcare workers and, you know, other people that help us maintain society. And we're very concerned with their safety. And, of course, the CDC was thinking about maybe going to a surgical mask recommendation. It looks like they stuck with their N95 type of respirator recommendation for H1N1. But, frankly, you know, I think that those are all back-ordered, and I don't know exactly the supply status in the different hospitals. What is your view on the surgical mask versus the N95?
I've frankly never seen any evidence that surgical masks protect someone who's healthy. There is very good evidence that if someone is sick, you put a surgical mask on whoever is sick, that will provide significant protection to people around that person. You know, now that tells, you know, if there's someone sick in your home, whether it's a kid or a spouse, and if that person is willing to wear a mask, which will make him or her uncomfortable, no question about it, you know, that will provide protection. But in terms of healthcare workers wearing masks, I believe there was a pretty good study in China of a few weeks ago, you know, which at least as reported, it was a pretty well conceived and well executed study, and it did reach that same conclusion that surgical masks are not useful. And as I say, I don't really know of any study, and that's not entirely true. I have seen one or two that suggest they may do some good. But even in 1918, they actually performed studies and discovered back then that surgical masks stopped something like 44% of the viruses, of the bacteria that came through. They didn't even know what a virus was in 1918. They couldn't grow one. So they had no way of measuring. But a virus is compared to a bacteria, is just so much smaller. So if 40-50% of the bacteria is getting through a surgical mask, and the masks are probably better now than they were in 1918, but still, it just doesn't stop a virus. So I just don't think they're helpful.
Right. Well, I agree. We're very pro healthcare worker, and we want to see them have the best protection available, the very best protection they can get in that situation, of course, because they have families and they don't need to get sick either. In the MIT presentation, you were talking about possibly the spring wave of 1918 conveying immunity for the fall wave. Did you want to talk? Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Or,
well, I think that's very clear, that in 1918, people got sick in a very, very mild spring wave. In fact, it was so mild in June and July, there were articles published in scientific journals in several countries suggesting that although the symptoms made the disease seem like influenza, it probably wasn't influenza because there were so few complications and so few deaths. Yet only a few weeks later, it became a really deadly pandemic, something why we're concerned now that it could turn into something like 1918. But there's very clear evidence from then that exposure in the spring was at least as good as a modern vaccine in terms of protecting you against the fall wave. And I feel very strongly on that.
So people, if they know they had it, but that would be it would be a lab confirmed, then they are protected and they wouldn't maybe necessarily get the shot. But the people who don't know, there would be millions of those people.
Yeah. Well, just because that did happen in 1918 is not a guarantee that exposure in the spring this time around or the summer would protect you in, from a subsequent wave. I think, for example, even in 1918, it's not at all clear. There was a very mild spring wave, and there was a very deadly fall wave, and then there was a third wave in January to March 1919. It's not at all clear that exposure in 1918 protected against the 1919 wave. Even though it was clearly the same virus. So, I would not extrapolate from the 1918 experience to reach the conclusion. I think it's likely, but I don't think it's a guarantee that if you're exposed in the spring this year, spring or summer, that you would be protected in the fall. Again, I think it's likely, but I don't think it's a guarantee. I don't really think it's a reason not to get the vaccine.
I agree. Most places are offering them free, maybe either completely free or an administration charge if it's a private, one of the clinics that the government has contracted with to dispense it. How do you feel about the pneumococcal vaccine?
That I think there's every reason to get that. Just in general, that's an excellent vaccine that does protect against most of the bacterial pneumonias that you'd be exposed to. Bacterial pneumonia following influenza is not uncommon. I think there's about an 8% case mortality rate for bacterial pneumonia that follows influenza, which is quite high, frankly. And a vaccine that protects you against most of those diseases is well worth taking, particularly for someone who's beginning to get up there. Just anecdotally, my brother had you know, pretty severe bacteria. He did survive. It was a long time ago. But that particular disease hits home in my family. I mean, I remember he was in the ICU for quite a while. He did recover fully, but I remember that time. You know, you walk around in this country and you think people don't die of infectious disease. Certainly not the way they used to, but you almost laugh them off. You don't take them seriously. But we really do need to take them seriously. They are a real threat, including bacterial pneumonias. I guess I've expressed myself on that. The one thing I was going to add in on that was going back to my book, actually. That was something that was actually developed in 1918. And they did have a fairly effective vaccine and serum treatment against the most common bacterial pneumonias. And the vaccine that you get today is actually a direct straight-line descendant of what they developed back then. And so it sort of reminds me about my book. I mean, the characters I wrote about, they were very, very good scientists. In fact, one of the key players in developing the pneumococcal vaccine, he spent 25 years of his life studying nothing but the pneumococcus, and ended up by studying the pneumococcus. He actually is a person who discovered that DNA carries the genetic code, certainly one of the most important scientific discoveries of the 20th century, and arguably the most important scientific discovery in the biological sciences. So, to me, that particular bacteria is sort of a very large significance.
Of course, we've been advocating wash your hands for a long time.
Right.
And turns out that some of the healthy, I would say maybe young adults or teenagers that have subsequently died or become very ill and almost died, had already a strep infection or something that wasn't diagnosed. And so keeping, I think, an overall clean hygienic situation is important, because you just lessen your overall exposure to a co-infection, and that, therefore, if you get a virus or something that maybe doesn't even go to bacterial pneumonia, but the least challenges that your body has, the better off you are.
You said it. I agree with you.
So, anyway, one question we had from some of the people on the site, they wanted to know, in your study of history, particularly 1918, what is just your overall takeaway message that you would tell people going into this situation here?
Well, first, obviously take it seriously. The fact that things seem mild at any given moment is not a guarantee that it remains mild. The second thing is you need to be flexible. The chief determinant of what's going to happen is going to be the virus itself, and not really anything that we do. We are forced into a fairly passive role reacting to the virus. I guess those would be the two main messages.
What would you consider some of the actions that were taken in that 1918 pandemic that should not be repeated this go around?
Well, primarily the goes back to the communication that we talked about earlier, partly because we were at war, partly because it was the instinct of everyone in government then and now that they want the public to be happy. Back then, people in the positions of authority essentially lied to the public about how serious the disease was and what was going on.
That was what Philadelphia, no?
It was everywhere.
Okay.
I just, used Philadelphia as a case study, since I could have picked almost any city in the country. There were a couple of very rare exceptions where people did tell the truth. The national public health leaders said that disease was referred to as Spanish influenza, and they said this is ordinary influenza by another name. You know, that's a statement made by a national public health leader. and yet people were dying sometimes 24 hours after the first symptoms, and they were dying with horrific symptoms. You know, probably the scariest, aside from, you know, turning blue from lack of oxygen, and it's, that's referred to as cyanosis. And, you know, the cyanosis was so intense, one physician said he couldn't tell Negro troops from white troops. So that, of course, spread rumors of black plague. But perhaps an even scarier symptom was when someone was bleeding, which was not uncommon, from not only from their nose and mouth, but actually from their eyes and ears. So when you're hearing from your public health officials, quote, this is ordinary influenza by another name, unquote, and then you're seeing people around you die and die with these horrific symptoms, you very quickly realize you're being lied to. And when you're being lied to, you lose all trust in authority, and then society begins to break down. I think that's part, of course, of what I wrote about, was that breakdown of society. And it's one of the reasons why I believe so firmly that telling the truth, you know, certainly you're facing a disease, but also really in any time kind of crisis situation, is, you know, first, you should tell the truth, because you should tell the truth, period. You know, I just believe that as a value system. But even if you're strictly viewing things from a pragmatic point of view, and you don't have any moral, you don't place any moral value on the truth, and that's not part of your decision-making process, I think that would be wrong. But there are people who think that way. But even from the strictly most pragmatic point of view, I think in a crisis situation, telling the truth is by far the best policy.
Weren't there, I guess, mortality and morbidity rates that were significantly different between Philadelphia, which had a breakdown society, and San Francisco, where their government officials, local government officials, told the truth? Didn't that actually translate to more people living?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, that may be the case, but the mortality varied so much from one city to another. I wouldn't ascribe any particular cause to that. You know, just looking at it honestly as an epidemiologist or any kind of objective observer, I wouldn't leap to the conclusion and say that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look across the country, the mortality rates varied enormously from one city to another, and we're still trying to figure out why that is. You know, several modelers have come up with the analysis of, you know, and that places that close schools and you know, ban public meetings and so forth early in the pandemic, that was effective. I'm actually, you know, I don't think they've answered a lot of questions about that to demonstrate that that's actually the truth. I think the data that goes into some of those models is a little bit weak, more than weak. In fact, I think it's not true. They still could be right. It's just hard to ascribe any particular thing. You know, that may well be the case. I think what is the case is that society continued to function in places where they told the truth. San Francisco, in fact, was pretty hard hit by the disease. But in San Francisco, the mayor, the city council, the leader of the business community, the trade unions all signed a huge full-page ad in the newspaper that said, wear a mask and save your life. And while the mask didn't do any good, that's a very different message that you're giving the public than saying, this is ordinary influenza by another name, and don't worry about it.
Sure.
And in San Francisco, the city did continue to function, whereas and nobody starved to death, for example, because they couldn't get food delivered to them when they were sick. whereas in Philadelphia and places around the country where lies were being told and people were being misled and society began to fracture and there was much greater panic, things like starvation actually did occur.
Well, you say in your paper that the healthcare system already drained of physicians and nurses by the military collapsed first. Elsewhere, fear, not illness, kept people at home. Absenteeism reached extraordinary levels. Shipyard workers were told that their duties were as important as the soldiers, and they were paid only if they worked. And unlike the few industries for which there are good data, it still ranged from 45% to 58%.
Right.
Telephone exchanges shut down, closing off communication, further isolating and alienating people. Grocers refused to open. Coal cellars closed. And people did, you know, starve to death on occasion when they couldn't get any food or get people to deliver food to them.
Sounds like fun, huh?
Well, so really what you're saying is that fear is the real enemy here, not so much even the illness. We can deal with the illness with vaccines and other things, but fear is probably the worst thing that can happen to us.
Well, the idea of everyone out for themselves and, again, the kind of stress on a society that comes I think lies generate, that the alienation that comes out of lying, yeah, I think that is a very, very, very serious concern, and that's something that can be avoided. Fortunately, right now, it doesn't look like we're facing anything like 1918, nothing like it, and we all hope it remains that way. As I say, I think, you know, trust is the glue that holds society together. Ultimately, I think society is based on trust, and I think you retain trust and retain that sort of glue that holds us all together by telling the truth.
We have just a few minutes left. Would you like to tell us about anything that you have coming up, any thing that you're writing or appearances that you're making?
Well, I've written two books about disasters. And, one is enough, and I've written two, so I'm not writing about any more disasters. I guess the other one you referred to earlier, Rising Tide, is about a flood on the Mississippi River that made almost 1% of the entire population of the United States homeless, and that occurred in 1927. So as far as what I'm writing, no more of that stuff. I'm not writing a book which hopefully we'll be out next year. It's been somewhat slowed down, both by Katrina and more recently by the time I've been spending on influenza. But it's about the separation of church and state in the 17th century, so a very, very different subject.
Well, it's an interesting one, but it isn't anything we cover on flu trackers, unfortunately. But
no.
It sounds like an interesting one.
I hope so. I will tell you that people in the White House do get information from flu trackers, so you're probably happy to hear that. And I think it's an excellent site.
Well, thank you very much. We really try to present the information unbiased. We have no, like I told you, we're not partisan. We're not religious. We're actually a 503c charity. We don't have any agenda except public health, and you know that's about what we try to accomplish. And I am really thrilled to hear that they do log on and look at our site. And, you know, we just try to, like you said, tell the truth, present what we find. Of course, we search all over the world for it.
Well, I mean, for example, it takes a while for things to get reported to CDC. Then CDC compiles it and releases it. And you're probably more than a week ahead on a lot of data, in some cases much more than a week ahead of CDC on a lot of data. In terms of getting it out there. So that's useful.
Well, that's great. And again, thank you so much for, spending time with us. And, we look forward to see you on the site every once in a while if you want to log on.
Okay. If I master my technological, let's just say I'm technically challenged and technologically challenged, as I think you know from prior conversations off the air.
Well, me too. So we're both of us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Do we have a little problem there?
Do we have a little problem there, Sharon? Well, I think Sharon just decided it was time to go, and there she went. So with that being said, it's almost time. We're going to play a couple of commercials, and we'll be back with For Your Eyes with Dr. Andrew Schatz. In fact, we'll play a little commercial for him right quick, and look forward to him being in momentarily. We'll be back right after this.
Is there?